thing about their celebration. "You really don't want me to call Mama?" I asked again. He turned and looked at me for the first time. "Promise me," he said, "that you'll say nothing. And if something happens to me, you'll always honor our parents." I swallowed. He was scaring me. "Look," he continued, "I've met a lot of rich kids and their parents at the academy. And I'll tell you, there are no parents that I'm prouder to have as my father and mother than ours. They rose up with nothing, Mundo, except guts and faith and love. Do you understand?" I shook my head. "No, I don't," I said. He licked his lips. He seemed to be licking his lips all the time now. "You will," he said. "You just pay close attention, and you will." He turned and began staring at the ceiling once again. I looked up at the ceiling too, but I couldn't find anything worth looking at, so I got up to go. "Remember," he said, "don't say anything to anyone. Júrame."
"Okay, te juro," I said.
"Good," he said, and he turned over, putting his face into his pillow. And I knew that he was crying again, but I didn't know what to do. So I just got dressed and went running down the stairs. The front patio was full of people. They were all talking at the same time and looking real excited. I could see that most of them had arrived in cars and trucks, but I could also see that a few had come on horseback or buggy. We would have horse races in the afternoon, and maybe even leaps of death, pasos de muerte, which meant jumping from a saddled horse to a bareback horse at a full run and riding the bareback horse to a standstill. The last time we'd done this, one of our vaqueros had been taken under a lemon tree by the bareback horse and almost cut to shreds by the thorns of our young lemon trees. But Nicolas, our foreman, who'd probably win the event, would have no trouble, because somehow he could mount a wild bareback horse and smooth-talk the horse with a gentle voice, and the horse would relax and trust him within seconds. It was about noon when big George Lopez and Bisteros came roaring up on their Harleys, grinning ear to ear like wild teenagers. My dad, who was now all dressed up in his half-charro, half-cowboy best, cussed them out, telling them that they were married men and shouldn't be risking their lives on those damn murder cycles. But George and Bisteros had already had quite a few, so they just laughed, and George told my dad, "How about you riding your horse through downtown Carlsbad drunker than a skunk?" "But horses got brains," yelled my dad back at George, "and my mare knew enough to get me home in one piece." "Well, Harley's got brains too," said George, laughing. "All right," said my dad, "have it your way. But just no scaring the livestock this time, cabrones." "You got it, Sal. Now let's have a serious drink," said George, grinning that drop-dead handsome grin of his. Myself, I was already drinking lemonade and eating golden chicharrones, which were being cooked on an open fire in the great big copper kettle that had been brought in from Guadalajara, Mexico. The pork was a golden brown color, and so delicious with a freshly made corn tortilla, a little lime, and salsa. By now there were already a couple of hundred people, and the mariachis were playing. This was when a real good-looking young man from the barrio de Carlos Malo came by me, headed for the beer keg that was high overhead on a rack with blocks of ice. He had the biggest smile I'd ever seen. "Hey, aren't you Salvador's son?" he asked me in Spanish. "Yes, I am," I said in Spanish too. "Could you get me a couple of those tacos de chicharrón?" "Sure, but come get them yourself," I said. "Everything is free." "Yeah, that's because your father is the king." "The king? The king of what?" "Of all this territory." "What territory?" "From Orange County down to San Diego on the coast and inland from San Bernardino all the way to Escondido." "What are you talking about?" I said. "Our ranch isn't that big." He quickly fixed himself a couple of tacos de chicharrón with plenty of lime, salsa, and cilantro. "This ranch is nothing," he said, biting into his taco. "It's just a cover. Don't you know who your father really is?"
He's El Capone,
he said with pride.
Oh, you mean Al Capone, that guy in the movies?
No, not Al Capone, he said, laughing as he continued eating. He's the real thing. He's El Capone, the man who castrates.
And he was so feared back in his day that people said that men's blood ran backwards to their heart if they even thought of double-crossing him.
My dad? Hell, I was your age when it was said that he'd castrated un hombre, cooked his balls in salsa verde, and forced the man to eat his own tanates.
Oh my God, I said in disgust. My dad did that? It sounded awful.
Hell, said the man with admiration. I personally saw him kill a man with his bare hands in the alley behind his pool hall when I was a kid.
You did, I said. And suddenly, I don't know how to explain it, but I could very clearly see that what this young man was saying to me could actually be true. How many times had I seen my father castrate livestock and then cook up their balls out in an open fire? A dozen times? No, more like 100. My head exploded. My heart was pounding, and an icy chill went up and down my spine as I looked at this young man who was devouring his tacos de chicharrón with such gusto. He was really good-looking, about 18 years old, the same age as my sister Tencha, more or less, and it didn't seem to me like he meant to be speaking badly about my father. No, he was grinning ear to ear, looking around at the huge place like he was in total admiration of me papa, El Capone, the castrator. But, oh my God, to castrate a man and then cook up his tanates and force him to eat his own balls, that was pretty damn... Yes, I mean pretty damn awful. Then what was all this crap about my dad telling me to respect life, that to kill even a snail was being disrespectful of God? I breathed, wondering if my brother Joseph knew this about our father. My heart continued to pound, and suddenly a dark cloud came overhead, taking away the bright sunlight. I turned and saw mi papa over there, talking to all these people, and he suddenly looked very different to me. Flashes of the barrio came bursting to my mind's eye, and I now remembered, like in a dream, my mother picking me up in her arms, waking up my brother and sister, and all of us running out the back door to hide behind the clothesline as this huge, awful monster came stumbling, bellowing to our home. I could now remember all this so clearly. There were huge white sheets flapping on the clothesline like great white birds trying to take flight. My mother was crying, and she held me close to her breasts. I could feel her terror. She was praying as fast as she could, begging God to please not let us be found. The tears were streaming down my mama's face and getting me all wet. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Could this huge monster have been my very own dad? He kept bellowing something about, "Mi familia! Mi familia! Where are you? I love you con todo mi corazón!" My brother Joseph wanted to go to the monster, but our mother held him fast. Then the bellow suddenly stopped, just like that. And my brother was the first one to go see the monster. And yes, the monster was our very own father, and he'd stopped bellowing because he'd passed out on the back porch into the awful-smelling puddle of his own puke. Our mother told Jose to leave our dad alone, that sleeping in his own puke served him right. But Jose disobeyed our mama, went inside and got a blanket, and moved our dad's face out of the puke, being really careful not to wake him, and covered him up. My mother wasn't crying anymore. No, now, with me still in her arms, she was looking up at the stars and thanking Papito Dios with all her heart. This, I now remember, was the first time in my life that I really looked up at the stars and saw how infinitely beautiful they were. I saw my mother had stopped crying and was talking to the stars. No wonder those big, ghostly white sheets kept trying to take flight, so they could be with the stars. The noise of the flapping sheets I'll never forget,
for at that moment I too began to flap my little arms, wanting to fly. The stars were our true home, I just knew it, here inside my heart and soul. Then I snapped out of it. I'd been like in a trance, and I saw that the housewarming celebration was going on all around me. This was when I saw that John Ford, whom my dad and I had met out by the front gates, was driving up in his baby blue convertible. He had a woman with him who had wild red hair. I'd never seen hair like that on any human, horse, or dog. It stood up real tall, looking like flames of fire leaping off her head. I quickly ran ahead to warn my dad, but I couldn't find him. There were hundreds and hundreds of people everywhere. I must have been off in my dreams for quite a while. I spotted Hans and Helen. They were talking with our town's mayor and several other city people. Jerry Bill, a close family friend, and Fred Noon, my parents' attorney, who were both from downtown San Diego, were walking up the driveway with a bunch of important-looking people. All these people had on real smooth, well-pressed clothes, clean shoes, and had a certain air about them. All of our neighbors and friends and familia had already arrived. My godparents, Vicente and Manuelita Arisa, had also arrived. Leo Meese and the Thills hadn't arrived yet. Jackie and Bert Lawrence, the most handsome young couple in all the world, were walking up. But only a few of our choice amigos from the barrio de Carlos Malo had been invited. My parents had made it known to everyone in the barrio that it was very important that there be no arguments between the gringos and Mexicanos on this day of their celebration. My uncle Archie Freeman had been put in charge of security. He had several armed men riding the grounds on horseback, keeping watch over matters. Men on horseback, just like the knights of old, Archie had explained to my dad, could keep a large crowd in order pretty easily. Finally, I spotted my father, but it was too late. John Ford and his red-haired woman were talking to Hans and Helen and to our Oceanside mayor. And now Hans turned around to introduce John to my father and mother, who'd just walked up. But when John Ford suddenly recognized my dad as the poor worker at the front gates, his whole mouth dropped open. "What?" shouted John, loud enough for everyone to hear. "You're the owner? Why, you son of a bitch!" he screamed, laughing. "I want my $5 back!" "Hell no!" yelled my father, laughing too. "You took it hook, line, and sinker, and that was the price for the story." "You con artist bastard," said John Ford, still laughing. No one knew what John and my father were talking about. "Now he's all dressed up like the Don himself," said John to everyone who was standing close by. "But 3 days ago, when he was working by the front gates with his son on a tractor, he was in the dirtiest old work clothes I've ever seen. And the bastard gets in my nice, clean car, acting like he doesn't know any better, and brushed all this dirt and cow manure over my nice new—" John didn't get to finish his words. Suddenly, out of nowhere, a lariat came down around John, roping him about the shoulders, yanking him up close. "No, Nicolas," yelled my father. "It's all right." "What the hell?" said John.
"Relax," said my dad. "It's okay, John. Everything's fine."
But Nicolas was hot, had the lariat dallied around the saddle horn, and was ready to give the horse his spurs and yank the gringo off his feet and drag him through the orchard. My father loosened the rope around John's shoulders and slipped it off.
"Good throw," my father said to Nicolas. "Good job. But we got to be careful and not overdo it."
Then turning to the crowd, he said, "Everything is okay. We just got a few horsemen working our celebration. Anyone who gets out of hand will be roped and dragged off, and then Archie will deal with you. This is a happy, peaceful occasion that Lupe and I have here. No guns will be fired up in the air. No fist fights or knife fights. This is a housewarming party." The woman with flaming red hair looked so excited that she could have popped.
"Honey, I liked seeing you roped," she said, snuggling up and down against John like a snake in mating season. "I want to learn how to do that."
Then turning to my dad, she said,
Then you must be the Al Capone of the West that my honey told me so much about?
No, not me, said my dad to the tall, beautiful, large-busted woman who just couldn't seem to stop her body from going up and down. You got me mixed up with someone else. I'm just a plain little law-abiding citizen like you and everyone else here.
But, honey, you told me that... I'm Fred Noon, Salvador and Lupe's attorney, said Noon, coming up and introducing himself to John and the woman, whose name was Mary. If you have any questions about Salvador and Lupe, feel free to come to my office any time.
John still couldn't stop grinning ear to ear. He was so happy.
Damn you, Salvador, he said to my father. The only thing you didn't lie about was your wife.
She is more beautiful than any movie star I've ever hired.
And he bowed, taking our mother's hand and kissing her fingertips.
You are a queen from head to toe, Lupe, he said.
You never say that to me,
snapped Mary, laughing.
Of course not, said John, turning to her. That's because you're my gorgeous wildflower.
I'll settle for a wildflower any day of the week, she said, grabbing him and kissing him hard on the mouth.
Myself, I was standing back and watching all this and feeling pretty confused. It seemed like everyone knew about my dad being El Capone and they liked it. This was really confusing to me. How could people like a man who put such fear into people's souls that their blood ran backwards from their heart? This made no sense. Did my dad then have monster frogs and lizards come up to him at night, too? It was now time to uncover the pit. This was the highlight of the whole celebration. And it was at this very moment that Harry and Bernice, my father and mother's tailors, came driving up in their car. They were from Santa Ana, and Harry had been the one who'd helped my father get my mother's diamond engagement ring for him when he'd asked for our mother's hand in marriage almost 20 years ago. Harry and his wife Bernice had the biggest, most beautifully wrapped housewarming present that I'd ever seen. It was huge. I could hardly wait to see what was in it.
From Harry and me, said Bernice, handing the huge gift wrapped in silver paper to my mother. For the two bravest, most loving young couple we ever met. Such struggles and so much love. Harry and me saw these two fine people during the Depression. And now look, a palace no less.
Bernice was crying, and my mother was crying, and so was Helen Huelster and my aunts Maria and Luisa. But my tia Tota, she wasn't crying. In fact, she was poking Archie in the ribs and making a face at him like she was angry with jealousy. The father's sun was finally setting, and now everyone was gathered at the pit. For our father, this was the most holy time of the whole fiesta. He took a shovel from one of the workmen, and carefully, he started helping the other men remove the last of the dirt. Then he helped them take off the corrugated metal sheets. An aroma suddenly filled the air straight from heaven. People were oohing and oh-ohing. And then, when the big bundles of meat and squash and corn and sweet potatoes were brought out of the hole and placed on the long and heavy wooden table, people were salivating. The smell was so powerful.
And now, before we eat, my beautiful wife, Lupe, the treasure de mi corazón, is going to make a toast, said our father.
Yes, said my mother, stepping forward with grace and dignity. We're all going to be served champagne and give...
Served in real crystal, a lo chingón, said my father, cutting in.
Thank you, Salvador, said my mother, refusing to be ruffled by our father's interruption. We'll just wait for everyone to get their glass of champagne, then we'll give our thanks. I watched the people who my parents had hired for the day serve the champagne to everyone. It was a long process. Even my sister Tencha and our cousins Chemo, Loti, Andres, Vicky, Eva, Benjamin, and all the others were served too. Quite a few of my male cousins were still overseas. One of them, my Aunt Sophia's son,
had actually made the national headlines as a war hero when he and his lieutenant had single-handedly captured nearly 100 Germans. But the newspaper article gave the credit to the young lieutenant, when it had actually been our cousin, a corporal, who'd come up with the idea and then handled the problema. "All right," said my mother. I could see that Mama was very nervous, but still she stepped forward with such calm elegance as if she'd been doing this all her life. "I'd like to start, as I said, by giving thanks to God. But I've never spoken publicly like this before. I'm not educated, so please pardon my English if I make any mistakes." She now raised her glass of champagne to the heavens. "Thank you, God. Thank you, our holy Creator, for giving my husband Salvador and I, Lupe, his wife, the opportunity to build this great home for our familia and our friends, new and old." Just then my brother came walking up, and he signaled for me and Tencha and our little sister Linda to come with him, up close to our parents. I was worried that our cousins would feel left out, but when I saw our mother's whole face light up with such joy as we four children came up to her and our father, I knew that my brother had done the right thing once again. "This is our familia," said our mother to everyone, "our two sons and our two daughters, Joseph, Tencha, Edmundo, and our newest child, Linda." I took my sister Tencha's hand. I could see that she was all embarrassed, too. My brother Joseph and my little sister Linda, on the other hand, didn't seem embarrassed at all. They were just glowing con gusto like our mother and father. "As you go inside of the gates of our front patio," continued my mother, "you will see that we had a little glassed-in shelf built into the pillars so we could house the statues of Joseph and Mary and Jesus. So, in the name of the earthly holy family of our Lord God, I invite everyone to now help us celebrate Nuestra Casa in peace and love and prosperity forever. Toast," added our mother, touching her glass to my father's, then my brother and Tencha's glasses. My little sister Linda and I had no glasses. I felt so left out. I could see that some people were actually wiping tears from their eyes as they lifted up their glasses to drink. Then my dad spoke up. "This toast," he said in a loud voice, "that my wonderful wife Lupe just made is fine for her, and I agree with her completely. Yes, amor and peace and prosperity are what we need here in this great nation of ours after that terrible depression and then this huge, long, awful World War II. But I'd also like to add that I, personally, didn't build this house just in honor of Joseph and Mary and Jesus. No, when we made plans to build this house, I immediately sent our architect to Hollywood to find how big Tom Mix's house was. Because when I first come to this country from Mexico, we see these Tom Mix movies in Arizona, with the gringos on the right side of the theater and the Mexicans and blacks on the left side. And we see that no good fake son of a bitch Tom Mix knocked down 5 Mexicanos with one punch. And one Sunday in Douglas, Arizona, I'll never forget, I was just a kid, this big handsome Mexicano from Los Altos de Jalisco got mad and jumped up on the stage in front of the movie and yelled, "Come on, you gringo bastards, see if one of you can knock me down with one punch, and I'll give you the first punch free, a lo chingon." And he ripped his shirt open and pounded his chest. And so, well, yes, of course, a fight got started. 2 men were killed, and 10 more hospitalized. So I tell you, when we started to build this house, I told our architect, go up to Hollywood and find out how big Tom Mix's house is, so we could build our casa bigger and better. So I now say to all of you,
that I didn't have this house built just for peace and love, but to also tell every damn human being on all the earth that here in Oceanside, California, stands un Mexicano de los buenos con sus tanates in hand, free to work or fight with both hands, whichever way the devil wants to paint it. And this is my toast a lo chingón. Salud!
Shouts erupted. A gun was fired. Once, twice, three times. And all the Mexicanos present went wild con gritos de gusto. Instantly, the man who'd fired his revolver was roped and taken off through the orchard. The mariachi started playing. People drank their champagne, were served more, and they began to line up to get their food. At the main table, the mayor and his wife sat down with our mother, Hans and Helen, Noon and his wife, and half a dozen other people. Then here came my father, carrying the huge platter covered with a white cloth. It smelled of heaven. He set it down in front of our mother and the mayor's wife, pulling off the cloth. This was an honor, the highlight of the whole barbacoa. The skinned-out steer's head with the horns, eyes bulging, and the mouth open with the tongue sticking out, surrounded with chiles and other colorful spices. It was a delicious, mouth-watering, beautiful sight. But the mayor's wife let out a screaming screech of pure terror and fell over backwards along with her chair. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Hell, my father hadn't even taken a tortilla to scoop the brains out of the huge skull to pass around as a kind of Mexican caviar to be eaten with the champagne yet. Quickly, my mother and Helen took the screaming mayor's wife inside the house to calm her down. My father, feeling pretty insulted by her outburst, said, "To hell with it! Let's switch from champagne to tequila!" The mayor, trying his best to keep calm and go along with everything, accepted a big shot of tequila from Los Altos de Jalisco, from where comes all the best tequila. And our great big housewarming celebration now became a real pachanga. Chapter 11. 2 weeks after the party, a car full of hombres drove up to our new house late one afternoon, honking their horn. They were from our old barrio of Carlsbad. I knew two of them. It was obvious that they were drunk and mad as hell. They just kept honking until we finally came out of the house.
"You're a turncoat, gringo-loving son of a bitch, cabrón!"
one of them shouted at my father as we came outside to see what it was that they wanted.
"You've forsaken your own people and gone over to the gringos like a cheap puta whore!"
"You're all just drunk," said my father, "so I'm going to ignore what you say. But you better turn your car around and leave before you get me mad."
"Ike, huh? What will you do?"
said the biggest man in the front passenger's seat, opening his door.
"You're not so tough anymore."
The man was so big that when he got out, the springs of the car rose up.
"I alone could kick your ass, Salvador."
My brother and I were behind our dad inside the gates of the front patio of our new home. The statue of the Blessed Mother was in the pillar to the left of us, and the statue of Saint Joseph holding baby Jesus in his arms was to the right of us. I didn't know what to do. There were four of them, and the one who'd got out of the car looked so much bigger and stronger and younger than our father that I was ready to pee in my pants. I thought of going inside to get a gun, but not my BB gun. I'd get my dad's 12-gauge shotgun, but I didn't know how to shoot it, and if I did, it would probably knock me over backwards. "Don't move," said my brother to me under his breath, as if reading my thoughts. "Papa knows what he's doing." I swallowed, hoping to God that my brother knew what he was talking about, because, my God, I had no idea what our poor old papa could do against this giant. "I said my father, as if he had all the time in the world, "we're amigos, and you're all just drunk. So I'll ignore these insults that you tell me here at my home, in front of my two sons, but just this one time. So you better now turn around and get out of here."
Mijito, he said, turning to me, get me a bottle of whiskey so that these fine gentlemen can enjoy a drink on their drive home.
Orale, said the one who was driving. Now you're talking, compa.
The giant grinned and licked his lips, salivating at the thought of another drink. Quickly, I ran into the house, but in our bar, I discovered that most of our liquor was gone. So I just grabbed a big bottle of something almost full, I didn't know what, and came racing back out. I was really terrified for our father. Here, I said to my dad, handing him the big bottle. My father took the bottle and started to hand it to the huge man who was standing in front of him. But swaying back and forth on his feet, the gigantic man took a closer look at the bottle that my father was handing him, and he roared.
This is shit, Salvador. That ain't a man's drink. It's that sweet green shit for women. Who do you think we are, you son of a bitch, cabrón?
Without a moment's hesitation, our father leaped at him, smashing the bottle across his face. The huge man dropped to the blacktop like our 1,000-pound steer had dropped under the pepper tree when the little .22 bullet hit him between the eyes. Our dad then broke the liquor bottle across the open door of their car, holding the bottle out like a weapon towards them, with all its broken, ugly, razor-sharp edges. Suddenly, my brother had a snub-nosed .38 in his hand. It was our father's gun. Joseph had been inside in bed when the car had first driven up. But he didn't need to do anything with the snub nose. Three of our vaqueros now came running up, and they had a crowbar, a lariat, and Emilio, our new foreman, had my dad's shotgun.
Put him in his car, said my father to our cowboys, and make sure these damn fools never come through our gates again. Why do you think I didn't invite you, cabrones? It's because of this, you stupid sons of bitches.
It's not over, Salvador,
yelled the driver.
Of course not. As long as you breathe, you'll be a damn fool who can't open his eyes and see what's going on.
They drove off, tires spinning and fishtailing up the driveway. I stood there transfixed, suddenly realizing that this was the same kind of action I'd seen in the barrio as a child behind our pool hall. I'd just forgotten. That good-looking young man's story about my dad being El Capón came flashing back to my mind. My God, it had to be true. It all had to be true. There just wasn't any doubt about it in my mind anymore. I started crying. I'd caused this whole thing to happen. If I'd brought out a bottle of men's drink instead of women's, they would have driven off happy, and I would have never endangered mi familia. When my father saw me crying, he came over to me. My brother had already put his arm around me.
It's okay, mijito, said my dad to me. You don't have to be scared anymore.
I'm not scared, I said, shoving my brother's arm away. I'm mad. I brought out the wrong liquor, and that's why all this happened. The workman laughed, saying that I looked cute being so angry. But my brother and father didn't laugh.
Look, mijito, said my dad, no matter what kind of liquor you would have brought out, it would have still ended up in a fight. That's what they came looking for, a fight. It couldn't be no other way.
Emilio was nodding in agreement with my father. That's why I brought the shotgun, he said. I could smell their want of fight from way across the orchard. You can smell somebody wanting to fight from across an orchard? I said, realizing that was one hell of a long way.
Sure, why not? Bulls can smell a cow in heat when the wind is right, 5 miles away, said Emilio. Anger, fear, sex, these are strong smells.
Exactly, said my father. Just as every married man must know, or he's going to get hit in his tanates with things from his wife that he has no idea where they're coming from. Smell, she is very important, mijito.
Is that why you cooked that man's tanates in salsa verde before you forced him to eat them, so he could smell them? I asked.
Ever since the housewarming celebration, I just hadn't been able to get those two stories out of my head. One, my dad castrating a man and cooking up his balls in salsa verde. Then the other, killing a man in the alley behind our pool hall in Carlos Malo with his bare hands. Also, every time I remembered those two stories, I'd remember that night with the white sheets flapping on the clothesline. My dad was grinning.
Who told you that one?
I was shocked. My dad was grinning like he truly enjoyed the memory of that awful story.
A guy at the house celebration? I said.
Yes, you're right. I wanted that man to smell his own Tanate's cooking, because I needed to teach that bastard a lesson he'd never forget for the rest of all his pinche life,
said my father with sudden anger. But then he breathed and breathed again, calming down.
You know, he said to me, I think the time has come where we maybe need to have a little talk.
And saying this, he took hold of me by the shoulders and turned me around.
You see, mijito, now that you are coming into manhood, you need to know what it is exactly that a man is and what it is that they do. Back home, at this time, was when my brother Jose, the Great, taught me how to shoot a gun, so no man, no matter how big, could ever walk on my shadow again without my permission. Jose, he said, turning to my brother, give me that pistol you brought out, and go in and get the .22 rifle and a bunch of bullets, so we can teach your little brother how to shoot. My father, said my dad, turning back to me, he never taught me nothing but hate and anger and how abusive men can be with all their power. It was my mother and her side of the familia, los indios, who taught me why it is that God made a man's balls so sensitive and easy to hurt.
My father had his huge hand on my left shoulder as we walked around our new home.
You see, to be a good hombre a las todas is to be, just like a man's balls, soft and tender inside your heart, and, yes, easy to be hurt. This is why all good men need to be raised like a woman for the first 7 years of their life. Those men who came in that car all drunk, they just don't know nothing about being soft and tender and honest deep inside.
I nodded. This really made a whole lot of sense.
What men do know this, Papa? I asked.
Not many anymore, he said. Nowadays, even most women are raised up to only admire the male way of thinking. The respect for women was lost, he added, when people started saying that God is only male. You see, back at one time, all over the world, two stories of creation were known. One for the women with a female god, so they could teach the young girls, and the other one for the men with a male god, so they could teach the young boys.
You mean there were two Bibles back in Eden? I asked.
Yes, of course. That only makes sense. No man and woman could ever agree on just one story.
Well, then, why do we now only have one Bible? I asked.
My father grinned.
You guess.
Because, I said, of men?
Exactly, he said. And how did you figure that out?
Because Eva doesn't blame Adam, it's Adam who blames Eva, I said.
Very good thinking, said my father, grinning. You got it. That's why it's so important to raise boys as girls for the first few years of their lives, so that then they'll at least have a little understanding of the...
Then was Jesus also raised like a woman for the first 7 years of his life? I asked.
Of course. That's why he was so strong and yet tender. All men back when the earth was young and the stars spoke and people knew how to listen were raised like women for the first 7 years of their life. In fact, back then, there were even two tongues, one for women and one for men. And the men who weren't raised like women for the first years of their life didn't even know how to speak to a woman when they grew up.
That makes a lot of sense, I said. Because I've heard some of our ranch hands say that there's no talking to a woman.
My father laughed.
And they're right, he said. There is no talking to a woman in a man's language.
My brother Joseph came up with the .22 rifle that my father used for killing the pigs, goats, and steer for the housewarming celebration, and a couple of boxes of ammunition.
Papa, I now asked, then, like Jesus, do you forgive those guys who came up in the car? Because they didn't really know what they were doing?
Forgiving, that's a tough one, said my dad, taking the rifle and beginning to load it. Sober, they're actually good men, especially the driver. So sober, then yes, I guess I do forgive them.
But drunk you don't?
No, drunk I don't. I'm still not as big of corazón as Jesus, he added.
I nodded. Things were now beginning to make a whole lot of sense to me once again. Then maybe my dad wasn't such a monster after all. Emilio and two of our ranch hands came up.
Here, said my dad, handing me the pistol. Take a good feel of this .38 special. It's loaded, he said. Always remember this. Guns are always loaded, whether they're loaded or not. So always keep your finger off the trigger and keep the barrel pointed that way, towards our target area on the hillside, where it's safe in case the gun goes off. I've seen many a man shot and some killed with what people thought were unloaded guns. Get it?
Yes, I said. I get it.
Good, he answered me.
We walked all the way around behind our new home and halfway down the hillside. We were just up the hill from the Tullys where the deer and fox lived, and the red-shouldered blackbirds came into roost each night by the tens of thousands. My dad took his time telling me all about weapons, and especially about this snub-nosed .38 Smith & Wesson, and how it compared to other handguns like the .44 and .45.
And some men spend their whole lives looking for the best gun, just like other men spend their lives looking for the best wife, he said. But these men are really just fools in the end, and cowards too. Because, mijito, when it's all said and done, it's never the gun or horse or wife or car or truck that does a good man in or saves his life. No, it's all here between the hombre's own two legs and how well he knows how to handle that gun, horse, wife, car, or truck. Give me any gun and I'll do good, no matter how the devil paints it for me. Why? Because I know what I'm doing and I've had a lot of practice.
Is that the same for women?
What?
That they need a lot of practice too, I said.
Emilio and the men smiled. Well, no, said my dad. We men like to think that it's only us, the men, who need to practice.
This makes no sense, I said. Why shouldn't women practice too, so they'll know how to handle a gun, horse, husband, car, or truck too?
Hearing this, Emilio and the other workmen burst out laughing, as if I'd asked the most ridiculous question in all of the world. I got mad and swung around at them with the .38 in hand before I realized what I'd done. They all jumped back. No! Screamed my dad, grabbing me and turning me back around. Watch what you're doing! I told you never to point a gun at anyone! And you, he said to Emilio and our two vaqueros, if you can't keep quiet, then get back to the barn.
They immediately calmed down, putting on serious faces. My brother never laughed.
That's a good question, my father said to me. That's why they got nervous and laughed. They weren't poking fun at you. You see, mijito, the truth is that for our women, we men like them not to be experienced when we marry them. But in time, yes, we do want them to learn how to do things well, said my dad.
But why don't men want women experienced when we first marry them? I asked.
Because, well, said my dad, glancing around and seeing that Emilio and the other men were trying their best to hold back their laughter. Because, mijito, most men, when they're thinking of marriage, prefer to do their own training of a woman, just as they do with their own horses. And also, men don't end up with babies, and women do, and so each man is afraid to think that it's another man's child that he's raising.
But why, I said, you just told me that when it's all said and done, that it doesn't matter which gun or horse or truck or wife, so why should it matter whose child?
Now Emilio and the two men couldn't hold back their laughter no matter how much they tried. Even my own brother was smiling. Because, well, es mucho más fácil criar que quitar mañas, said my father.
Exactly, said Emilio. Es mucho más fácil poner rienda que enderezar una mujer mula.
Thank you, said my father to Emilio. Are you beginning to understand, mijo? It's easier to raise than remove bad habits. It's easier to put on rein than to try to straighten out a stubborn, mule-headed woman.
I shook my head.
But all this still makes no sense, I said. You've always told me that women are 10 times smarter and tougher than men. So then, why don't women get the experience and then train us, the men?
Well, I must have said the most crazy, loco thing in all the world, because now one of our vaqueros was laughing so hard that he fell down on the ground holding his stomach. They were all in wild hysterics.
What's so funny? I yelled. I like riding on a horse that's experienced and already well-trained, so why not with a woman?
The howling laughter of the men continued, no matter how hard my dad tried to stare them down. Now even my own brother was laughing.
You know, said my father, I think that we've talked enough for one day. Remember, you're only 8 years old. In time, you'll understand. Now, let's get back to the easy part of being a man and teach you how we shoot a gun.
You mean shooting guns is easier than knowing how to be with women? That makes no sense either. I get along real easy with my mama and my sisters and their women.
Fine. I'm glad to hear this, said me papa. And that's the way it should be. Now, pay close attention, he said, taking the .38 snub-nose away from me and unloading the weapon.
He handed it back to me and turned me about facing the hillside and had me dry-fire the revolver without bullets at the hillside. The .38 felt big and heavy, and when the hammer was back, the trigger was real light.
Now, watch, he said, reloading the gun. You go first, Chava boy.
Taking the snub-nosed revolver, my brother shot at the hillside, not quite hitting the little rock that he was shooting at. Man, the gun was loud. Even the horses way out in the valley lifted up their heads to look towards us. Myself, I'd had to cover up my ears real tight with my hands. My brother shot 5 times.
I've never been very good with handguns, said Joseph. I'm much better with a rifle.
Papa, he's good with either one.
Not that good, said our dad, taking the .38 special and reloading it. I just get lucky sometimes.
He quickly took aim and started firing, blowing that little rock to smithereens. Boy, was I ever impressed, and so were my brother and Emilio and the other workmen. Then it was my turn. I was nervous as hell. I'd never fired a real gun before.
Use both of your hands and square yourself, facing forward, said my father. You'll have to get a lot bigger to handle a .38 or .45 with one hand. But always remember, if you ever have to face another man, you use one hand and turn sideways, so this way you're a smaller target and you can move and slide.
I did as told, squaring myself to the target, and I'd shot a lot with my BB gun. But my God, when I took aim with this big, black, heavy snub nose and squeezed back on this trigger, the weapon suddenly leaped up in my hand like a snake, almost breaking my wrists, and sent exploding fire out the barrel. And the sound! My ears were ringing like nobody's business. Everyone was laughing. I guess I was staring cross-eyed at what I'd just shot. I'd missed the little rock that I'd aimed at by 5 feet. Handguns were really very different from rifles. All afternoon we spent shooting. The workers got to shoot, too. With the .22 rifle, my brother was really good. But our dad, my God, he could hit the center of a nickel every time. In the barrio, Papa would throw quarters into the air and hit them, said my brother with a big smile. That's how he stopped the fights between the Marines and the Batos.
You'd stop fights, Papa? I asked.
Sure, of course. I was the peacemaker of the barrio, said my dad, just as Archie was the law and peacemaker before me. So when the Marines came to the barrio asking for trouble, I didn't insult them. They were just kids, so I'd take them behind the pool hall and teach them how to shoot. After the war, 2 of them came back saying that I'd saved their lives with what I teach them.
Yes, I said excitedly. Now I remember. You'd shoot at quarters on the tree by Mama Grande's house, wouldn't you?
Yes, that's right, said my dad.
Then you did good things in the barrio too? I asked.
Sure. Yeah, of course, said my dad.
But I was told that you killed a man with your bare hands in the alley behind our pool hall, I said.
Who told you that one? The same guy who said I castrated a man and forced him to eat his own tanates? I nodded.
Listen to me closely, said my father, very closely. Yes, I did castrate a pig and forced a man to eat the pig's balls. Then I pulled down that man's pants, asking him if he preferred to eat his own balls cooked in salsa verde or salsa colorada. But he never stopped screaming, he was so terrified, so I never had to castrate him. And when I let him go, he went back to Los Angeles, telling his people to never come back to Carlos Malo. Get it, mijito? I got done what I needed to get done to protect my territory. All bears do this, all lions do this. And that man in the alley, yes, I beat him. And then I put him in the trunk of my car and drove him out to that big eucalyptus forest behind Carlsbad so he could walk it off before he caused any more trouble. The next day, he left town back to Mexico. The people of the barrio never saw him again, so some started saying that I'd beat him to death and took his body out towards Vista to bury it.
So then, why haven't you told people that you didn't kill that man? And that you really didn't castrate that other one.
What? And ruin my reputation? Said my father, laughing. Hell no! I worked too hard to get my reputation. And fear is a damn good thing, mijito, when the other guy has it and you don't.
I shook my head. All this really didn't make any sense to me. But I could see that the workers loved my dad's explanation. I guess that maybe there was still a lot for me to learn, even though I was already 8 years old. The father's sun was setting when we started up the hill. The shooting was done. Emilio and the vaqueros had left to go and take care of the stock. It was just my brother and father and me walking back towards the house. Papa, those men in the car, I asked, if you knew that it was going to end up in a fight anyway because you could smell it, then why did you tell me to go get some whiskey?
Because, mijito, maybe it could have helped, said my father. And also, because it gave me a little more time to think, caused the driver to remember that we're friends and to call me a compa, and to give Emilio time to come with help.
Just wait, I said. Then you mean that those guys are friends of ours?
Well, of course, said my dad, laughing. No enemy would ever come up to a home angry because they didn't get invited to a celebration. You just remember, mijito, whenever your wife comes screaming at you that she's going to kill you because you forgot her birthday, that what she's really saying is, I love you. I depend on you for my life and love, and so this is why I hate you and want to kill you. It's always with our wife, our best friends, and our relatives that we end up having most of our troubles in life, mijito. A man's enemies are never his biggest problema. That's all just a bunch of bullshit lies in the stupid, no-good fake movies like Tom Mix used to make, making us Los Mexicanos into bad people. Mi mama always used to say, there are no bad people on earth. Once we've learned how to open your eyes and really see.
But, Papa, I said, Superman, he's a superhero just like Batman, and they're always out chasing bad people.
Those two guys aren't married, are they? Asked me Papa.
No, they aren't, I said.
Tell me, where would Superman be if he was married and his wife was mad at him for being late for dinner? Or he forgot her birthday or anniversary because he was out chasing bad guys.
My eyes went huge. My God, he'd be in deep trouble, Papa. My brother started laughing, but this wasn't a laughing matter for me. This was really important. Yeah, sure, I'd always known that Superman and Batman weren't really real, that they were cartoons, but the stories of what they did, I'd always thought were good and true, and was what we, the men, were supposed to do if we wanted to be heroes in our own lives. Then, Papa, I said, Are you saying that Superman and Batman are fake and cowards because they aren't married?
You tell me, said my dad. The sudden fear that went shooting all through me made me want to stop thinking about all this. I'd never questioned the Bible or Superman or Batman before. It was bad enough when I'd questioned Santa Claus, because I'd begun to think that there was no way that he could get around the whole world delivering presents in one night. I'd told my school friend Whataking that reindeer weren't that fast, even if they could fly. I figured that it had to be our parents who gave us our Christmas presents. Whataking went bananas and started crying, then hit me with his roller skates across the head, almost killing me. I was beginning to find out that what we'd been raised to think was no small laughing matter. As I went up the hill that night to our home with my brother and father, my whole head was swimming. All this stuff about going into manhood seemed a hell of a lot harder than having been raised like a woman, where everything had just made such blessed, good horse sense.
Chapter 12.
A screeching ambulance rushed my brother Joseph to Scripps Hospital in La Jolla. My parents had finally taken our brother to another doctor, a young man recently out of the Navy. Dr. Pace just took one look at Joseph, saw how yellow the whites of his eyes were, and immediately had him rushed to Scripps Hospital. After several days of tests, Dr. Pace explained to my parents that my brother's liver was ruined. My dad wanted to know how this terrible thing could have happened. Dr. Pace said he didn't know. My dad told him that was bullshit, that he could see it in his eyes that he wasn't telling them everything. Dr. Pace added that if Joseph had just been hospitalized a couple of months earlier, they could have put him on juices, particularly cranberry juice, and his situation would have never gotten this far. Coming home that night, my father was so mad that he wanted to drive up California Street to kill Dr. Hoskins with his bare hands. It was only my mother's screaming and pleading that finally stopped our dad from killing the doctor who'd been attending to Joseph all this time. Specialists were brought in from across the country. Every week, my brother was taken back and forth from our home to Scripps in La Jolla. And for me, school continued, and now all of my friends, including Whataking, were in the fourth grade, but I was still in the third. My brother was hurting, and the magic went out of my marble playing. A lot of the kids started beating me, even the smaller kids who were in the third grade with me. Once more, I began to draw stars every chance I got, 5-pointed ones and 6-pointed ones. Then I'd color in the stars with green and blue and little touches of red and yellow. One day, my parents' arguing got so bad while my brother was down at Scripps that I went upstairs to draw my stars so I could disappear. My little sister Linda followed me and found me drawing stars on a big piece of cardboard on the floor outside our balcony, which overlooked all of our property. She told me that she wanted to draw too, so I showed her how I'd recently learned to draw stars with a ruler so I could get the lines real straight. Then I'd color them in, and it would make me feel really good. All that afternoon, my little sister drew stars with me, and all this time we could hear our parents arguing downstairs. Our mother was crying and saying that she was sure that God was punishing her and our father for something that they'd done, and so she was asking God to please take her and not our brother.
"Please, dear Papito, our son Joseph is innocent," she was saying to God. "No child should be held responsible for their parents' sins."
"Lupe, why do you talk like this?" said our father.
"God doesn't punish children for their parents' mistakes. Come on, Lupe, we just need to find the right doctor. Dr. Pace says that there's still hope."